I don't know what has been done to you. I can only guess what your life has been like. But know this. You will not be bridgemen in my camp. Nor will you be slaves. But what is a man's life worth? Dalinar asked softly. The slave masters say one is worth about 2 emerald bromes, Kaladin said, frowning. And what do you say? A life is priceless, he said immediately, quoting his father. Dalinar smiled, wrinkle lines extending from the corners of his eyes. Coincidentally, that is the exact value of a shard blade. So today, you and your men sacrifice to buy me 2,600 priceless lives, and all I had to repay you with was a single priceless sword. I call that a bargain. You really think it was a good trade, don't you? Kaladin said, amazed. Dalinar smiled in a way that seemed strikingly paternal. For my honor? Unquestionably. Go and lead your men to safety, soldier. Later tonight I will have some questions for you. Kaladin glanced at Sadeus, who held his new blade with awe. You said you'd take care of Sadeus. This was what you intended? This wasn't taking care of Sadeus, Dalinar said. This was taking care of you and your men. I still have work to do today. Dalinar found King Elokar in his palace sitting room. Dalinar nodded once more to the guards outside, then closed the door. They seemed troubled. As well they should. His orders had been irregular, but they would do as told. They wore the king's colors, blue and gold, but they were Dalinar's men, chosen specifically for their loyalty. The door shut with a snap. The king was staring at one of his maps, wearing his shard plate.
Ah, uncle, he said, turning to Dalinar. Good. I had wanted to speak with you. Do you know of these rumors about you and my mother? I realize that nothing untoward could be happening, but I do worry about what people think.
Dalinar had crossed the room, booted feet thumping on the rich rug. Infused diamonds hung in the corners of the room, and the carved walls had been set with tiny chips of quartz to sparkle and reflect the light.
Honestly, uncle, Elokar said, shaking his head, I'm growing very intolerant of your reputation in camp. What they are saying reflects poorly on me, you see, and—
He trailed off as Dalinar stopped about a pace from him.
Uncle? Is everything all right? My door guards reported some kind of mishap with your plateau assault today, but my mind was full of thoughts. Did I miss anything vital?
Yes, Dalinar said. Then he raised his leg and kicked the king in the chest. The strength of the blow tossed the king backward against his desk. The fine wood shattered as the heavy shardbearer crashed through it. Elokar hit the floor, his breastplate cracked just faintly. Dalinar stepped up to him, then delivered another kick to the king's side, cracking the breastplate again. Elokar began shouting in panic.
Guards! To me! Guards!
Nobody came. Dalinar kicked again, and Elokar cursed, catching his boot. Dalinar grunted, but bent down and grabbed Elokar by the arm, then yanked him to his feet, tossing him toward the side of the room. The king stumbled on the rug, crashing through a chair. Round lengths of wood scattered, splinters spraying out. Wide-eyed, Elokar scrambled to his feet. Dalinar advanced on him.
What has gone wrong with you, uncle? Elokar yelled. You're mad! Guards! Assassin in the king's chamber! Guards!
Elokar tried to run for the door, but Dalinar threw his shoulder against the king, tossing the younger man to the ground again. Elokar rolled, but got a hand under himself and climbed to his knees, the other hand to the side. A puff of mist appeared in it as he summoned his blade. Dalinar kicked the king's hand just as the shard blade dropped into it. The blow knocked the blade free, and it dissolved back to mist immediately. Elokar frantically swung a fist at Dalinar, but Dalinar caught it, then reached down and hauled the king to his feet. He pulled Elokar forward and slammed his fist into the king's breastplate. Elokar struggled,
But Dalinar repeated the move, smashing his gauntlet against the plate, cracking the steel casings around his fingers, making the king grunt. The next blow shattered Elokar's breastplate in an explosion of molten shards. Dalinar dropped the king to the floor. Elokar struggled to rise again, but the breastplate was a focus for the shard plate's power. Missing it left arms and legs heavy. He knelt on one knee beside the squirming king. Elokar's shard blade formed again, but Dalinar grabbed the king's wrist and smashed it against the stone floor, knocking the blade free yet again. It vanished into mist.
"Guards!" Elokar squealed. "Guards! Guards! Guards!"
"They won't come, Elokar," Dalinar said softly. "They're my men, and I left them with orders not to enter, or let anyone else enter, no matter what they heard. Even if that included pleas for help from you."
Elokar fell silent.
"They are my men, Elokar," Dalinar repeated. "I trained them. I placed them there. They've always been loyal to me."
"Why, Uncle? What are you doing? Please tell me."
He was nearly weeping. Dalinar leaned down, getting close enough to smell the king's breath.
"The girth on your horse during the hunt," Dalinar said quietly. "You cut it yourself, didn't you?"
Elokar's eyes grew wider.
"The saddles were switched before you came to my camp," Dalinar said. "You did that because you didn't want to ruin your favorite saddle when it flew free of the horse. You were planning for it to happen. You made it happen. That's why you've been so certain that the girth was cut."
Cringing, Elokar nodded.
"Someone was trying to kill me, but you wouldn't believe. I worried it might be you, so I decided I..."
"You cut your own strap," Dalinar said, "to create a visible, obvious-seeming attempt on your life. Something that would get me or Sadeus to investigate."
Elokar hesitated, then nodded again. Dalinar closed his eyes, breathing out slowly.
"Don't you realize what you did, Elokar? You brought suspicion on me from across the camps. You gave Sadeus an opportunity to destroy me."
He opened his eyes, looking down at the king.
"I had to know," Elokar whispered. "I couldn't trust anyone."
He groaned beneath Dalinar's weight.
"What of the cracked gemstones in your shard plate? Did you place those too?"
"No."
"Then maybe you did uncover something," Dalinar said with a grunt. "I guess you can't be completely blamed."
"Then you'll let me up?"
"No."
Dalinar leaned down farther. He laid a hand against the king's chest. Elokar stopped struggling, looking down in terror.
"If I push," Dalinar said, "you die. Your ribs crack like twigs. Your heart is smashed like a grape. Nobody would blame me. They all whisper that the Blackthorn should have taken the throne for himself years ago. Your guard is loyal to me. There would be nobody to avenge you. Nobody would care."
Elokar breathed out as Dalinar pressed his hand down just slightly.
"Do you understand?" Dalinar asked quietly.
"No."
Dalinar sighed, then released the younger man and stood up. Elokar inhaled with a gasp.
"Your paranoia may be unfounded," Dalinar said, "or it may be well-founded. Either way, you need to understand something. I am not your enemy."
Elokar frowned.
"So you're not going to kill me?"
"Storms, no. I love you like a son, boy."
Elokar rubbed his chest.
"You have very odd paternal instincts."
"I spent years following you," Dalinar said. "I gave you my loyalty, my devotion, and my counsel. I swore myself to you, promising myself, vowing to myself, that I would never covet Gavilar's throne. All to keep my heart loyal. Despite this, you don't trust me. You pull a stunt like that one with the girth, implicating me,
giving your own enemy's position against you without knowing it. Dalinar stepped toward the king. Elokar cringed. Well, now you know, Dalinar said, voice hard. If I'd wanted to kill you, Elokar, I could have done it 12 times over. 100 times over. It appears you won't accept loyalty and devotion as proof of my honesty. Well, if you act like a child, you get treated like one. You know now, for a fact, that I don't want you dead. For if I did, I would have crushed your chest and been done with it. He locked eyes with the king. Now, Dalinar said, do you understand? Slowly, Elokar nodded. Good, Dalinar said. Tomorrow you're going to name me High Prince of War.
What?
Sadeus betrayed me today, Dalinar said. He walked over to the broken desk, kicking at the pieces. The king's seal rolled out of its customary drawer. He picked it up. Nearly 6,000 of my men were slaughtered. Adolin and I barely survived.
What?
Elokar said, forcing himself up to a sitting position.
That's impossible.
Far from it, Dalinar said, looking at his nephew. He saw a chance to pull out, letting the Parshendi destroy us. So he did it. A very Alethi thing to do. Ruthless, yet still allowing him to feign a sense of honor or morality.
So, you expect me to bring him to trial?
No. Sadeus is no worse and no better than the others. Any of the High Princes would betray their fellows if they saw a chance to do it without risking themselves. I intend to find a way to unite them in more than just name. Somehow. Tomorrow, once you name me High Prince of War, I will give my plate to Renarin to fulfill a promise. I've already given away my blade to fulfill a different one. He walked closer, meeting Elokar's eyes again, then gripped the king's seal in his hand. As High Prince of War, I will enforce the codes in all 10 camps. Then I'll coordinate the war effort directly, determining which armies get to go on which plateau assaults. All gem hearts will be won by the throne, then distributed as spoils by you. We'll change this from a competition to a real war. And I'll use it to turn these 10 armies of ours, and their leaders, into real soldiers.
Stormfather, they'll kill us. The High Princes will revolt. I won't last a week.
They won't be pleased, that's for certain, Dalinar said. And yes, this will involve a great deal of danger. We'll have to be much more careful with our guard. If you're right, someone is already trying to kill you, so we should be doing that anyway. Elokar stared at him, then looked at the broken furniture, rubbing his chest.
You're serious, aren't you?
Yes. He tossed the seal to Elokar. You're going to have your scribes draw up my appointment right after I leave.
But I thought you said it was wrong to force men to follow the codes, Elokar said. You said that the best way to change people was to live right, and then let them be influenced by your example.
That was before the Almighty lied to me, Dalinar said. He still didn't know what to think of that. Much of what I told you, I learned from the Way of Kings. But I didn't understand something. Noadon wrote the book at the end of his life, after creating order, after forcing the kingdoms to unite, after rebuilding lands that had fallen in the desolation. The book was written to embody an ideal. It was given to people who already had momentum in doing what was right. That was my mistake. Before any of this can work, our people need to have a minimum level of honor and dignity. Adolin said something to me a few weeks back, something profound. He asked me why I forced my sons to live up to such high expectations, but let others go about their errant ways without condemnation. I've been treating the other high princes and their light eyes like adults. An adult can take a principle and adapt it to his needs. But we're not ready for that yet. We're children. And when you're teaching a child, you require him to do what is right until he grows old enough to make his own choices. The Silver Kingdoms didn't begin as unified, glorious bastions of honor. They were trained that way, raised up like youths nurtured to maturity. He strode forward, kneeling down beside Elokar. The king continued to rub his chest, his shardplate looking strange with the central piece missing.
"We're going to make something of Alethkar, nephew," Dalinar said softly. "The High Princes gave their oaths to Gavilar, but now ignore those oaths. Well, it's time to stop letting them. We're going to win this war, and we're going to turn Alethkar into a place that men will envy again. Not because of our military prowess, but because people here are safe, and because justice reigns. We're going to do it, or you and I are going to die in the attempt."
"You say that with eagerness."
"Because I finally know exactly what to do," Dalinar said, standing up straight. "I was trying to be Noadon the Peacemaker, but I'm not. I'm the Blackthorn, a general and a warlord. I have no talent for backroom politicking, but I am very good at training troops. Starting tomorrow, every man in each of these camps will be mine. As far as I'm concerned, they're all raw recruits. Even the High Princes."
"Assuming I make the proclamation."
"You will," Dalinar said. "And in return I promise to find out who is trying to kill you."
Elokar snorted, beginning to remove his shardplate piece by piece.
"After that announcement goes out, discovering who's trying to kill me will become easy. You can put every name in the war camps on the list."
Dalinar's smile widened.
"At least we won't have to guess, then." "Don't be so glum, nephew. You learned something today. Your uncle doesn't want to kill you."
"He just wants to make me a target."
"For your own good, son," Dalinar said, walking to the door. "Don't fret too much. I've got some plans on how exactly to keep you alive."
He opened the door, revealing a group of nervous guards keeping at bay a nervous group of servants and attendants.
"He's just fine," Dalinar said to them. "See?"
He stepped aside, letting the guards and servants in to attend their king. Dalinar turned to go, then he hesitated.
"Oh, and Elokar? Your mother and I are now courting. You'll want to start growing accustomed to that."
Despite everything else that had happened in the last few minutes, this got a look of pure astonishment from the king. Dalinar smiled and pulled the door closed, walking away with a firm step. Most everything was still wrong. He was still furious at Sarius, pained by the loss of so many of his men, confused at what to do with Navani, dumbfounded by his visions, and daunted by the idea of bringing the war camps to unity. But at least now he had something to work with.
Part 5. The Silence Above. Shallan, Dalinar, Kaladin, Zeth, Wit. 70. Sea of Glass. Shallan lay quietly in the bed of her little hospital room. She'd cried herself dry, then had actually retched into the bedpan over what she had done. She felt miserable. She'd betrayed Yasna, and Yasna knew. Somehow, disappointing the princess felt worse than the theft itself. This entire plan had been foolish from the start. Beyond that, Capsule was dead. Why did she feel so sick about that? He'd been an assassin trying to kill Yasna, willing to risk Shallan's life to achieve his goals. And yet, she missed him. Yasna hadn't seemed surprised that someone would want to kill her. Perhaps assassins were a common part of her life. She likely thought Capsule a hardened killer, but he'd been sweet with Shallan. Could that all really have been a lie? He had to be somewhat sincere, she told herself, curled up on her bed. If he didn't care for me, why did he work so hard to get me to take the jam? He had handed Shallan the antidote first, rather than taking it himself. And yet he did take it eventually, she thought. He put that fingerful of jam into his mouth. Why didn't the antidote save him? This question began to haunt her. As it did, something else struck her, something she would have noticed earlier had she not been distracted by her own betrayal. Yasna had eaten the bread. Arms wrapped around herself, Shallan sat up, pulling back to the bed's headboard. She ate it, but she wasn't poisoned, she thought. My life makes no sense lately. The creatures with the twisted heads, the place with the dark sky, the soul casting, and now this. How had Yasna survived? How? With trembling fingers, Shallan reached to the pouch on the stand beside her bed. Inside, she found the garnet sphere that Yasna had used to save her. It gave off weak light. Most had been used in the soul casting. It was enough light to illuminate her sketch pad sitting beside the bed. Yasna probably hadn't even bothered to look through it. She was so dismissive of the visual arts. Next to the sketch pad was the book Yasna had given her. The Book of Endless Pages. Why had she left that? Shallan picked up the charcoal pencil and flipped through to a blank page in her sketchbook. She passed several pictures of the symbol-headed creatures, some drawn of this very room. They lurked around her, always. At times she thought she saw them in the corners of her eyes. At others she could hear them whispering. She hadn't dared speak back to them again. She began to draw, fingers unsteady, sketching Yasna on that day in the hospital. Sitting beside Shallan's bed, holding the jam, Shallan hadn't taken a distinct memory and wasn't as accurate as if she had, but she remembered well enough to draw Yasna with her fingers stuck into the jam. She had raised that finger to smell the strawberries. Why? Why put her finger into the jam? Wouldn't raising the jar to her nose have been enough? Yasna hadn't made any faces at the scent. In fact, Yasna hadn't mentioned that the jam had spoiled. She'd just replaced the lid and handed back the jar. Shallan flipped to another blank page and drew Yasna with a piece of bread raised to her lips. After eating it, she'd grimaced. Odd. Shallan lowered her pen, looking at that sketch of Yasna, piece of bread pinched between her fingers. It wasn't a perfect reproduction, but it was close enough. In the sketch, it looked like the piece of bread was melting, as if it were squished unnaturally between Yasna's fingers as she put it into her mouth. Could it be? Shallan slid out of the bed, gathering the sphere and carrying it in her hand, sketchpad tucked under her arm. The guard was gone. Nobody seemed to care what happened to her. She was being shipped off in the morning anyway. The stone floor was cold beneath her bare feet. She wore only the white robe and felt almost naked. At least her safe hand was covered. There was a door to the city outside at the end of the hallway, and she stepped through it. She crossed quietly through the city, making her way to the Relinsa, avoiding dark alleyways. She walked up toward the conclave, long red hair blowing free behind her, drawing more than a few strange looks and stares. It was so late at night that nobody on the roadway cared enough to ask if she wanted help. The master servants at the entrance to the conclave let her pass. They recognized her, and more than a few asked if she needed help. She declined, walking alone down to the vale. She passed inside, then looked up at the walls full of balconies, some of them lit with spheres. Yasna's alcove was occupied. Of course it was. Always working, Yasna was. She'd be particularly bothered by having lost so much time over Shallan's presumed suicide attempt. The lift felt rickety beneath Shallan's feet as the parshman lifted her up to Yasna's level. She rode in silence, feeling disconnected from the world around her, walking around through the palace, through the city, in only a robe, confronting Yasna Kolin again? Hadn't she learned? But what did she have to lose? She walked down the familiar stone hallway to the alcove, weak blue sphere held before her. Yasna sat at her desk. Her eyes looked uncharacteristically fatigued, dark circles underneath, her face stressed. She looked up and stiffened as she saw Shallan. You are not welcome here, Shallan walked in anyway, surprised by how calm she felt. Her hands should be shaking.
"Don't make me call the soldiers to get rid of you," Yasna said. "I could have you thrown in prison for 100 years for what you did. Do you have any idea what
the soul caster you wear is a fake?" Shallan said quietly. "It was a fake the whole time, even before I made the swap."
Yasna froze.
"I wondered why you didn't notice the switch," Shallan said, sitting in the room's other chair. "I spent weeks confused. Had you noticed, but decided to keep quiet in order to catch the thief? Hadn't you soul cast in all that time? It didn't make any sense. Unless the soul caster I stole was a decoy."
Yasna relaxed.
"Yes. Very clever of you to realize that. I keep several decoys. You're not the first to try to steal the Fabriel, you see. I keep the real one carefully hidden, of course."
Shallan took out her sketchpad and searched through for a specific picture. It was the image she'd drawn of the strange place with the sea of beads, the floating flames, the distant sun in a black, black sky.
Shallan regarded it for a moment, then she turned it and held it up for Yasna.
The look of utter shock Yasna displayed was nearly worth the night spent feeling sick and guilty.
Yasna's eyes bulged, and she sputtered for a moment, trying to find words.
Shallan blinked, taking a memory of that. She couldn't help herself.
"Where did you find that?" Yasna demanded. "What book described that scene to you?"
"No book, Yasna," Shallan said, lowering the picture. "I visited that place. The night when I accidentally soul-cast the goblin in my room to blood, then covered it up by faking a suicide attempt."
"Impossible. You think I'd believe
there is no Fabriel, is there, Yasna? There's no soul-caster. There never has been. You use the fake Fabriel to distract people from the fact that you have the power to soul-cast on your own."
Yasna fell silent.
"I did it, too," Shallan said. "The soul caster was tucked away in my safe pouch. I wasn't touching it, but that didn't matter. It was a fake. What I did without it. Perhaps being near you has changed me somehow. It has something to do with that place and those creatures."
Again, no reply.
"You suspected Capsule of being an assassin," Shallan said. "You knew immediately what had happened when I fell. You were expecting poison, or at least were aware that it was possible. But you thought the poison was in the jam. You soul-cast it when you opened the lid and pretended to smell it. You didn't know how to recreate strawberry jam. And when you tried, you made that vile concoction. You thought to get rid of poison, but you inadvertently soul-cast away the antidote. You didn't want to eat the bread either, just in case there was something in it. You always refused it. When I convinced you to take a bite, you soul-cast it into something else as you put it in your mouth. You said you're terrible at making organic things, and what you created was revolting. But you got rid of the poison, which is why you didn't succumb to it."
Shallan met her former mistress's eyes. Was it the fatigue that made her so indifferent to the consequences of confronting this woman? Or was it her knowledge of the truth?
"You did all that, Yasna," Shallan finished, "with a fake soul caster. You hadn't spotted my swap yet. Don't try to tell me otherwise. I took it on the night when you killed those three thugs."
Yasna's violet eyes showed a glimmer of surprise.
"Yes," Shallan said, "that long ago. You didn't replace it with a decoy. You didn't know you'd been tricked until I got out the Fabriel and let you save me with it. It's all a lie, Yasna."
"No," Yasna said. "You're just delusional from your fatigue and the stress."
"Very well," Shallan said. She stood up, clutching the dim sphere. "I guess I'll have to show you, if I can."
"Creatures," she said in her head.
"Can you hear me?"
"Yes, always," a whisper came in response.
Though she'd hoped to hear it, she still jumped.
"Can you return me to that place?" she asked. You need to tell me something true, it replied. The more true, the stronger our bond.
Yasna is using a fake soulcaster, Shallan thought. I'm sure that's a truth.
That's not enough, the voice whispered. I must know something true about you. Tell me. The stronger the truth, the more hidden it is, the more powerful the bond. Tell me. Tell me. What are you?
What am I? Shallan whispered. Truthfully? It was a day for confrontation. She felt strangely strong, steady. Time to speak it. I'm a murderer. I killed my father.
Ah, the voice whispered. A powerful truth indeed.
And the alcove vanished. Shallan fell, dropping into that sea of dark glass beads. She struggled, trying to stay at the surface. She managed it for a moment, then something tugged on her leg, pulling her down. She screamed, slipping beneath the surface, tiny beads of glass filling her mouth. She panicked. She was going to... The beads above her parted. Those beneath her surged, bearing her upward, out to where someone stood, hand outstretched. Yasna, back to the black sky, face lit by nearby hovering flames. Yasna grasped Shallan's hand, pulling her upward onto something, a raft, made from the beads of glass. They seemed to obey Yasna's will. Idiot girl, Yasna said, waving. The ocean-like beads to the left split, and the raft lurched, bearing them sideways toward a few flames of light. Yasna shoved Shallan into one of the small flames, and she fell backward off the raft, and hit the floor of the alcove. Yasna sat where she had been, eyes closed. A moment later she opened them, giving Shallan an angry look.
Idiot girl, Yasna repeated. You have no idea how dangerous that was. Visiting Shadesmar with only a single dim sphere, idiot!
Shallan coughed, feeling as if she still had beads in her throat. She stumbled to her feet, meeting Yasna's gaze. The other woman still looked angry but said nothing. She knows that I have her, Shallan realized. If I spread the truth, what would it mean? She had strange powers. Did that make Yasna some kind of void bringer? What would people say? No wonder she'd created the decoy.
I want to be part of it, Shallan found herself saying.
Excuse me?
Whatever you're doing, whatever it is you're researching, I want to be part of it.
You have no idea what you're saying.
I know, Shallan said. I'm ignorant. There's a simple cure for that.
She stepped forward.
I want to know, Yasna. I want to be your ward in truth. Whatever the source of this thing you can do, I can do it too. I want you to train me and let me be part of your work.
You stole from me.
I know, Shallan said. And I'm sorry.
Yasna raised an eyebrow.
I won't excuse myself, Shallan said. But Yasna, I came here intending to steal from you. I was planning it from the beginning.
That's supposed to make me feel better?
I planned to steal from Yasna the bitter heretic, Shallan said. I didn't realize I'd come to regret the need for that theft. Not just because of you, but because it meant leaving this. What I've come to love. Please. I made a mistake.
A large one. Insurmountable.
Don't make a larger one by sending me away. I can be someone you don't have to lie to. Someone who knows.
Yasna sat back.
I stole the Fabriel on the night you killed those men, Yasna, Shallan said. I decided I couldn't do it, but you convinced me that truth was not as simple as I thought it. You've opened a box full of storms in me. I made a mistake. I'll make more. I need you.
Yasna took a deep breath.
Sit down.
Shallan sat.
You will never lie to me again, Yasna said, raising a finger. And you will never steal from me or anyone again.
I promise.
Yasna sat for a moment,
then sighed. "Scoot over here," she said, pulling open a book.
Shallan obeyed as Jasnah took out several sheets filled with notes.
"What is this?" Shallan asked. "You wanted to be part of what I'm doing? Well, you'll need to read this."
Jasnah looked down at the notes.
"It's about the Voidbringers."
Recorded in blood. Zeth Sun-Sun Valano, truthless of Shinovar, walked with bowed back, carrying a sack of grain down off the ship and onto the docks of Carbranth. The city of Bells smelled of a fresh ocean morning, peaceful yet excited, fishermen calling to friends as they prepared their nets. Zeth joined the other porters, carrying his sack through the twisting streets. Perhaps another merchant might have used a chul cart, but Carbranth was infamous for its crowds and its steep walkways. A line of porters was an efficient option. Zeth kept his eyes down, partially to imitate the look of a worker, partially to lower his gaze from the blazing sun above, the god of gods, who watched him and saw his shame. Zeth should not have been out during the day. He should have hidden his terrible face. He felt his every step should leave a bloody footprint. The massacres he'd committed these months, working for his hidden master. He could hear the dead scream every time he closed his eyes. They grated against his soul, rubbing it to nothing, haunting him, consuming him. So many dead. So very many dead. Was he losing his mind? Each time he went on an assassination, he found himself blaming the victims. He cursed them for not being strong enough to fight back and kill him. During each of his slaughters, he wore white, just as he had been commanded. "One foot in front of the other. Don't think. Don't focus on what you've done. On what you're going to do." He reached the last name on the list. Taravangian, the king of Carbranth. A beloved monarch, known for building and maintaining hospitals in his city. It was known as far away as Aesir that if you were sick, Taravangian would take you in. Come to Carbranth and be healed. The king loved all. And Zeth was going to kill him. At the top of the steep city, Zeth lugged his sack with the other porters around to the back of the palace structure, entering a dim stone corridor. Taravangian was a simple-minded man. That should have made Zeth feel more guilty. But he found himself consumed by loathing. Taravangian would not be smart enough to prepare for Zeth. Fool. Idiot. Would Zeth never face a foe strong enough to kill him? Zeth had come to the city early and taken the job as a porter. He had needed to research and study, for the instructions commanded him, for once, not to kill anyone else in performing this assassination. Taravangian's murder was to be done quietly. Why the difference? The instructions stated that he was to deliver a message. "The others are dead. I've come to finish the job." The instructions were explicit. Make certain Taravangian heard and acknowledged the words before harming him. This was looking like a work of vengeance. Someone had sent Zeth to hunt down and destroy the men who had wronged him. Zeth laid his sack down in the palace larder. He turned automatically, following the shuffling line of porters back down the hallway. He nodded toward the servant's privy, and the portermaster waved for him to go ahead. Zeth had made this same hall on several occasions and could be trusted, presumably, to do his business and catch up. The privy didn't smell half as foul as he had anticipated. It was a dark room, cut into the underground cavern, but a candle burned beside a man standing at the pissing trough. He nodded to Zeth, tying up the front of his trousers and wiping his fingers on the sides as he walked to the door. He took his candle, but kindly lit a leftover stub before withdrawing. As soon as he was gone, Zeth infused himself with stormlight from his pouch, and laid his hand on the door, performing a full lashing between it and the frame, locking it closed. His shard blade came out next. In the palace, everything was built downward. Trusting the maps he'd purchased, he knelt and carved a square of rock from the floor, wider at the bottom. As it began to slide down, Seth infused it with stormlight, performing half a basic lashing upward, making the rock weightless. Next, he lashed himself upward with a subtle lashing that left him weighing only a tenth his normal weight. He leapt onto the rock, and his lessened weight pushed the rock down slowly. He rode it down into the room below. Three couches with plush violet cushions lined the walls, sitting beneath fine silver mirrors. The light eyes privy. A lamp burned with a small flame in the sconce, but Zeth was alone. The stone thumped softly to the ground, and Zeth leaped off. He shed his clothing, revealing a black and white master servant's outfit underneath. He took a matching cap from the pocket and slipped it on, reluctantly dismissed his blade, then slipped into the hallways and quickly lashed the door shut. These days he rarely gave a thought to the fact that he walked on stone. Once he would have revered a corridor of rock like this. Had that man once been him? Had he ever revered anything? Zeth hurried onward. His time was short. Fortunately, King Teravangian kept a strict schedule. Seventh bell, private reflection in his study. Zeth could see the doorway into the study ahead, guarded by two soldiers. Zeth bowed his head, hiding his shin eyes and hurrying up to them. One of the men held out his hand warningly, so Zeth grabbed it, twisting, shattering the wrist. He smashed his elbow into the man's face, throwing him back against the wall. The man's stunned companion opened his mouth to yell, but Zeth kicked him in the stomach. Without even a shard blade, he was dangerous, infused with stormlight and trained in Kamar. He grabbed the second guard by the hair and slammed his forehead against the rock ground. Then he rose and kicked open the door. He walked into a room well illuminated by a double row of lamps on the left. Crammed bookcases covered the right wall from floor to ceiling. A man sat cross-legged on a small rug directly ahead of Zeth. The man looked out an enormous window, cut through the rock, staring at the ocean beyond. Zeth strode forward.
"I have been instructed to tell you that the others are dead. I've come to finish the job."
He raised his hands, shard blade forming. The king did not turn. Zeth hesitated. He had to make certain the man acknowledged what had been said.
"Did you hear me?"
Zeth demanded, striding forward.
"Did you kill my guards, Zeth son Velano?"
the king asked quietly. Zeth froze. He cursed and stepped backward, raising his blade in a defensive stance. "Another trap?"
"You have done your work well," the king said, still not facing him. "Leaders dead, lives lost, panic and chaos. Was this your destiny? Do you wonder? Given that monstrosity of a shard blade by your people, cast out and absolved of any sin your masters might require of you." "I am not absolved," Zeth said, still wary. "It is a common mistake stonewalkers make. Each life I take weighs me down, eating away at my soul. The voices, the screams, spirits below, I can hear them yelling." "Yet you kill." "It is my punishment," Zeth said. "To kill. To have no choice, but to bear the sins nonetheless. I am truthless."
"Truthless," the king mused. "I would say that you know much truth. More than your countrymen now."
He finally turned to face Zeth, and Zeth saw that he had been wrong about this man. King Teravangian was no simpleton. He had keen eyes and a wise, knowing face, rimmed with a full white beard, the mustaches drooping like arrow points.
You have seen what death and murder do to a man. You could say, Zeth, son, Belano, that you bear great sins for your people. You understand what they cannot. And so you have truth.
Zeth frowned, and then it began to make sense. He knew what would happen next, even as the king reached into his voluminous sleeve and withdrew a small rock that glittered in the light of 2 dozen lamps.
You were always him, Zeth said. My unseen master.
The king set the rock on the ground between them. Zeth's oath stone.
You put your own name on the list, Zeth said. In case you were captured,
Taravangian said.
The best defense against suspicion is to be grouped with the victims.
And if I'd killed you?
The instructions were explicit,
Taravangian said.
And, as we have determined, you are quite good at following them. I probably needn't say it, but I order you not to harm me. Now, did you kill my guards?
I do not know,
Zeth said, forcing himself to drop to one knee. He spoke loudly, trying to drown out the screams that he thought, for certain, must be coming from the upper eaves of the room.
I knocked them both unconscious. I believe I cracked one man's skull.
Taravangian breathed out, sighing. He rose, stepping to the doorway. Zeth glanced over his shoulder to note the aged king inspecting the guards and seeing to their wounds. Taravangian called for help, and other guards arrived to see to the men. Zeth was left with a terrible storm of emotions. This kindly, contemplative man had sent him to kill and murder? He had caused the screams? Taravangian returned.
Why?
Zeth asked, voice hoarse.
Vengeance?
No,
Taravangian sounded very tired.
Some of those men you killed were my dear friends, Zeth, son, Valano.
More insurance, Zeth spat. To keep yourself from suspicion?
In part. And in part because their deaths were necessary.
Why? Zeth asked. What could it possibly have served?
Stability. Those you killed were among the most powerful and influential men in Roshar.
How does that help stability?
Sometimes,
Taravangian said,
you must tear down a structure to build a new one with stronger walls.
He turned around, looking out over the ocean.
And we are going to need strong walls in the coming years. Very, very strong walls.
Your words are like the 100 doves.
Easy to release, difficult to keep,
Taravangian said, speaking the words in Shin. Zeth looked up sharply. This man spoke the Shin language and knew his people's proverbs? Odd to find in a stonewalker. Odder to find in a murderer.
Yes, I speak your language. Sometimes I wonder if the Life Brother himself sent you to me.
To bloody myself, so that you wouldn't have to, Zeth said.
Yes,
that sounds like something one of your Boren gods would do.
Taravangian fell quiet.
Get up,
he finally said. Zeth obeyed. He would always obey his master. Taravangian led him to a door set into the side of the study. The aged man pulled a sphere lamp off the wall, lighting a winding stairwell of deep, narrow steps. They followed it and eventually came to a landing. Taravangian pushed open another door and entered a large room that wasn't on any of the palace maps that Zeth had purchased or bribed to look at. It was long, with wide railings on the sides, giving it a terraced look. Everything was painted white. It was filled with beds, hundreds and hundreds of them. Many were occupied. Zeth followed the king, frowning. An enormous hidden room, cut into the stone of the conclave? People bustled about, wearing coats of white.
A hospital? Zeth said. You expect me to find your humanitarian efforts a redemption for what you have commanded of me?
This is not humanitarian work,
Taravangian said, walking forward slowly, white and orange robes rustling. Those they passed bowed to him with reverence. Taravangian led Zeth to an alcove of beds, each with a sickly person in it. There were healers working on them, doing something to their arms, draining their blood. A woman with a writing clipboard stood near the beds, pen held, waiting for something. What?
I don't understand, Zeth said, watching in horror as the four patients grew pale. You're killing them, aren't you?
Yes. We don't need the blood. It is merely a way to kill slowly and easily.
Every one of them? The people in this room?
We try to select only the worst cases to move here. For once they are brought to this place, we cannot let them leave if they begin to recover.
He turned to Zeth, eyes sorrowful.
Sometimes we need more bodies than the terminally sick can provide. And so we must bring the forgotten and the lowly, those who will not be missed.
Zeth couldn't speak. He couldn't voice his horror and revulsion. In front of him, one of the victims, a man in his younger years, expired. Two of those remaining were children. Zeth stepped forward. He had to stop this. He had to...
You will still yourself,
Taravangian said.
And you will return to my side.
Zeth did as his master commanded. What were a few more deaths? Just another set of screams to haunt him? He could hear them now, coming from beneath beds, behind furniture.
Or I could kill him, Zeth thought. I could stop this.
He nearly did it, but honor prevailed. For the moment.
You see, Zeth, son, Velano,
Taravangian said,
I did not send you to do my bloody work for me. I do it here myself. I have personally held the knife and released the blood from the veins of many. Much like you, I know I cannot escape my sins. We are two men of one heart. This is one reason why I sought you out.
But why?
Zeth said. On the beds, a dying youth started speaking. One of the women with the clipboards stepped forward quickly, recording the words.
The day was ours, but they took it, the boy cried. Stormfather, you cannot have it. The day is ours. They come rasping and the lights fail. Oh, Stormfather!
The boy arched his back, then fell still suddenly, eyes dead. The king turned to Zeth.
It is better for one man to sin than for a people to be destroyed. Wouldn't you say, Zeth, son, Velano?
Aye.
We do not know why some speak when others do not,
Taravangian said.
But the dying see something. It began 7 years ago, about the time King Gavilar was investigating the shattered plains for the first time.
His eyes grew distant.
It is coming, and these people see it. on that bridge between life and the endless ocean of death, they view something. Their words might save us.
You are a monster.
Yes,
Teravangian said.
But I am the monster who will save this world.
He looked at Zeth.
I have a name to add to your list. I had hoped to avoid doing this, but recent events have made it inevitable. I cannot let him seize control. It will undermine everything.
Who? Zeth asked, wondering if anything at all could horrify him further.
Dalinar Kholin, Teravangian said. I'm afraid it must be done quickly, before he can unite the Alethi High Princes. You will go to the Shattered Plains and end him.
He hesitated.
It must be done brutally, I'm afraid.
I have rarely had the luxury of working otherwise, Zeth said, closing his eyes. The screams greeted him.
Veristatalion. Before I read, Shallan said, I need to understand something. You soul-cast my blood, didn't you? To remove the poison, Yasna said. Yes. It acted extremely quickly. As I said, it must have been a very concentrated form of the powder. I had to soul-cast your blood several times as we got you to vomit. Your body continued to absorb the poison. But you said you aren't good with organics, Shallan said. You turned the strawberry jam into something inedible. Blood isn't the same, Yasna said, waving her hand. It's one of the essences. You'll learn this, should I actually decide to teach you soul casting. For now, know that the pure form of essence is quite easy to make. The 8 kinds of blood are easier to create than water, for instance. Creating something as complex as strawberry jam, however, a mush made from a fruit I'd never before tasted or smelled, was well beyond my abilities. And the Ardents, Shallan said. Those who soul cast, do they actually use fabrials? Or is it all a hoax? No. Soul casting fabrials are real. Quite real. So far as I know, everyone else who does what we can do, uses a fabrial to accomplish it. What of the creatures with the symbol heads? Shallan asked. She flipped through her sketches, then held up an image of them. Do you see them too? How are they related? Yasna frowned, taking the image. You see beings like this? In Shadesmar? They appear in my drawings, Shallan said. They're around me, Yasna. You don't see them? Am I? Yasna held up a hand. These are a type of spren, Shallan. They are related to what you do. She tapped the desk softly. 2 orders of the Knights Radiant possessed inherent soul-casting ability. It was based on their powers that the original fabrials were designed, I believe. I had assumed that you... But no, that obviously wouldn't make sense. I see now. What? I will explain as I train you, Yasna said, handing back the sheet. You will need a greater foundation before you can grasp it. Suffice it to say that each Radiant's abilities were tied to the spren. Wait, Radiance? But I will explain, Yasna said. But first we must speak of the Voidbringers. Shallan nodded. You think they'll return, don't you? Yasna studied her. What makes you say that? The legends say the Voidbringers came 100 times to try to destroy mankind, Shallan continued. I read some of your notes. You what? I was looking for information on soul casting, Shallan confessed. Yasna sighed. Well, I suppose it is the least of your crimes. I can't understand, Shallan said. Why are you bothering with these stories of myths and shadows? Other scholars, I know you respect, consider the Voidbringers to be a fabrication. Yet you chase stories from rural farmers and write them down in your notebook. Why, Jasnah? Why do you have faith in this when you reject things that are so much more plausible? Jasnah looked over her sheets of paper. Do you know the real difference between me and a believer, Shallan? Shallan shook her head. It strikes me that religion, in its essence, seeks to take natural events and ascribe supernatural causes to them. I, however, seek to take supernatural events and find the natural meanings behind them. Perhaps that is the final dividing line between science and religion. Opposite sides of a card. So, you think the Voidbringers had a natural, real-world correlate? Jasnah said firmly. I'm certain of it. Something caused the legends. What was it? Jasnah handed Shallan a page of notes. These are the best I've been able to find. Read them. Tell me what you think. Shallan scanned the page. Some of the quotes, or at least the concepts, were familiar to her from what she'd read already. Suddenly dangerous, like a calm day that became a tempest. They were real, Jasnah repeated. Beings of ash and fire. We fought with them, Jasnah said. We fought so often that men began to speak of the creatures in metaphor. 100 battles. 10 10-folds. Flame and char. Skin so terrible. Eyes like pits of blackness. Music when they kill. We defeated them, Jasnah said. Shallan felt a chill. But the legends lie about one thing, Jasnah continued. They claim we chased the Voidbringers off the face of Roshar, or destroyed them. But that's not how humans work. We don't throw away something we can use. Shallan rose, walking to the edge of the balcony, looking out at the lift, which was slowly being lowered by its 2 porters. Parchment, with skin of black and red. Ash and fire. Stormfather, Shallan whispered, horrified. We didn't destroy the Voidbringers, Jasnah said from behind, her voice haunted. We enslaved them.
73. Trust. The chill spring weather might finally have slipped back into summer. It was still cool at night, but not uncomfortably so. Kaladin stood on Dalinar Kolin's staging ground, looking eastward over the shattered plains. Ever since the failed betrayal and subsequent rescue earlier, Kaladin had found himself nervous. Freedom. Bought with a shard blade. It seemed impossible. His every life experience taught him to expect a trap. He clasped his hands behind him. Syl sat on his shoulder. Dare I trust him? He asked softly.
He's a good man, Syl said. I've watched him. Despite that thing he carried.
That thing?
The shard blade.
What do you care about it?
I don't know,
she said, wrapping her arms around herself.
It just feels wrong to me. I hate it. I'm glad he got rid of it. Makes him a better man.
Noman, the middle moon, began to rise. Bright and pale blue, bathing the horizon in light. Somewhere, out across the plains, was the Parshendi shardbearer that Kaladin had fought. He'd stabbed the man in the leg from behind. The watching Parshendi had not interfered with the duel, and had avoided attacking Kaladin's wounded bridgeman. But Kaladin had attacked one of their champions from the most cowardly position possible, interfering with a fight. He was bothered by what he'd done, and that frustrated him. A warrior couldn't worry about who he attacked or how. Survival was the only rule of the battlefield. Well, survival and loyalty. And he sometimes let wounded enemies live if they weren't a threat, and he saved young soldiers who needed protection, and he'd never been good at doing what a warrior should. Today he'd saved a High Prince, another Light Eyes, and along with him thousands of soldiers. Saved them by killing Parshendi. "Can you kill to protect?" Kaladin asked out loud. "Is that a self-contradiction?"
I don't know.
"You acted strangely in the battle," Kaladin said, "swirling around me. After that you left. I didn't see much of you."
"The killing," she said softly. "It hurt me. I had to go."
"Yet you were the one who prompted me to go and save Dalinar. You wanted me to return and kill."
"I know."
"Teft said that the Radiance held to a standard," Kaladin said. "He said that by their rules you shouldn't do terrible things to accomplish great ones. Yet what did I do today? Slaughter Parshendi in order to save Alethi. What of that? They aren't innocent, but neither are we. Not by a faint breeze or a storm wind." Syl didn't reply. "If I hadn't gone to save Dalinar's men," Kaladin said, "I would have allowed Sadeas to commit a terrible betrayal. I'd have let men die who I could have saved. I'd have been sick and disgusted with myself. I also lost 3 good men, bridgemen who were mere breaths away from freedom. Are the lives of the others worth that?"
"I don't have the answers, Kaladin."
"Does anyone?" Footsteps came from behind. Syl turned.
"It's him."
The moon had just risen. Dalinar Kholin, it appeared, was a punctual man. He stepped up beside Kaladin. He carried a bundle under his arm, and he had a military air about him, even without his shard plate on. In fact, he was more impressive without it. His muscular build indicated that he did not rely on his plate to give him strength, and the neatly pressed uniform indicated a man who understood that others were inspired when their leader looked the part.
"Others have looked just as noble," Kaladin thought.
"But would any man trade a shard blade just to keep up appearances? And if they would, at what point did the appearance become reality?" "I'm sorry to make you meet me so late," Dalinar said. "I know it has been a long day."
"I doubt I could have slept anyway."
Dalinar grunted softly as if he understood. "Your men are seen too?"
"Yes," Kaladin said. "Quite well, actually. Thank you."
Kaladin had been given empty barracks for the bridgemen, and they had received medical attention from Dalinar's best surgeons. They'd gotten it before the wounded light-eyed officers had. The other bridgemen, the ones who weren't from Bridge 4, had accepted Kaladin immediately without any thought on the matter as their leader. Dalinar nodded.
"How many do you suspect will take my offer of a purse and freedom?"
"A fair number of the men from other crews will, but I'll wager an even larger number won't. Bridgemen don't think of escape or freedom. They wouldn't know what to do with themselves. As for my own crew, well, I have a feeling that they'll insist on doing whatever I do. If I stay, they'll stay. If I go, they'll go."
Dalinar nodded.
"And what will you do?"
"I haven't decided yet."
"I spoke to my officers," Dalinar grimaced. "The ones who survived. They said that you gave orders to them, took charge like a Light Eyes. My son still feels bitter about the way your conversation went with him."
"Even a fool could see he wasn't going to be able to get to you. As for the officers, most were in shock or run ragged. I merely nudged them."
"I owe you my life twice over," Dalinar said, "and that of my son and my men."
"You paid that debt."
"No," Dalinar said. "But I've done what I can."
He eyed Kaladin, as if sizing him up, judging him.
"Why did your bridge crew come for us? Why, really?
Why did you give up your shard blade?"
Dalinar held his eyes, then nodded.
"Fair enough.
I have an offer for you. The king and I are about to do something very, very dangerous. Something that will upset all the war camps.
Congratulations.
Dalinar smiled faintly. My honor guard has nearly been wiped out, and the men I do have are needed to augment the king's guard. My trust is stretched thin these days. I need someone to protect me and my family. I want you and your men for that job.
You want a bunch of bridgemen as bodyguards?
The elite ones as bodyguards, Dalinar said. The ones of your crew. The ones you trained. I want the rest as soldiers for my army. I have heard how well your men fought. You trained them without Sadeus knowing, all while running bridges. I'm curious to see what you could do with the right resources.
Dalinar turned away, glancing northward, toward Sadeus's camp.
My army is depleted. I'm going to need every man I can get. But everyone I recruit is going to be suspect. Sadeus will try to send spies into our camp, and traitors and assassins. Elokar thinks we won't last a week.
Stormfather, Kaladin said. What are you planning?
I'm going to take away their games, fully expecting them to react like children losing their favored toy.
These children have armies and shardblades.
Unfortunately.
And this is what you want me to protect you from?
Yes.
No quibbling, straightforward. There was much to respect about that.
I'll augment Bridge 4 to become the honor guard, Kaladin said, and train the rest as a spearman company. Those in the honor guard get paid like it.
Generally, a Light Eye's personal guard got triple a standard spearman's wage.